Zone, podcasts featuring interviews and commentary from Animal Rights Zone, the online social network for humans who seek justice for other animals. You can find us on the web at www.arzone.net. I'm your host, Carolyn Bailey. Today's episode features our special guest, Nick Cooney. Nick and I will be joined by ARZone admin Tim Geyer. Nick Cooney is the Compassionate Communities Campaign Manager for Farm Sanctuary. Nick's also the author of Change of Heart, What Psychology Can Teach Us About Spreading Social Change, which Veg News named as one of its top 10 books of 2011. And he's also the founder of the Humane League, which is an advocacy organization that works to protect other animals through public education, campaigns, and rescue. Nick has written for publications including the Philadelphia Inquirer and Z Magazine, and his advocacy work has been featured in hundreds of media outlets including Time Magazine, The Wall Street Journal, and National Public Radio. He holds a degree in nonviolent studies from Hofstra University and previously worked conducting nutrition education programs with the University of Pennsylvania's Urban Nutrition Initiative. Thank you so much for being here with us today, Nick, and welcome to ARZone.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Nick, I know that you've recently been attending the AR conference in Washington, D.C., and we'd like to speak with you about that. But before we do, in the opening pages of your book, Change of Heart, you mention a short story about what activists say they're willing to give up in order to bring about the changes they wish to see. Could you please recount that story for us now and explain why it's so important?
Yeah, absolutely. So I was a senior in college, and we had an individual come by named Dan Ferger, who was a campaigner for the Rainforest Action Network, which was it's an environmental organization. And we were working, our student club was working with that organization on trying to pressure Citibank into no longer lending money to environmentally destructive projects. And so Dan Ferger came in, and he gave this very interesting anecdote that has stuck with me ever since. I don't know whether this is a true anecdote or a made-up anecdote, but it's one that I think has a lot of value. So basically, the anecdote goes like this. There was an environmental campaigner, and he was speaking to a group of young environmentalists. And he was getting them all fired up. You know, it was before a big protest. And so he said to them, you know, he called out to the crowd, how many of you here today are willing to fight for the environment? And everyone cheered. And he said, and how many of you here today are willing to get arrested for the environment? And again, everyone in the crowd cheered. They were ready to get arrested. And they said, how many of you are ready to die for the environment? And, you know, got a lot of people cheering for that, too. And then he said, and how many of you are willing to put on a suit and tie to help the environment? And the crowd went silent. And so that's the anecdote. Again, I don't know if it's true or made up, but I think it conveys a very powerful point, and that is that while we all feel very passionately about the cause we have, the question still remains in terms of, you know, what can we do that's going to make us as effective as possible, and what changes, including changes to our personal beliefs, our personal identity, things like that, what of those things are we willing to be open to changing if we know that those can indeed save the lives of animals? So, yeah, that was the anecdote. It's one that's stuck with me ever since.
It's a fascinating story. When I think you spoke about it in your ARZone chat as well last year, and I think it's a really interesting story. Thanks for that, Nick.
Of course.
As I said, you've been recently at the Animal Rights Conference in Washington, D.C. What's been the most interesting or rewarding part of that conference this year? Could you speak to our listeners a little bit about the conference and what it's actually designed to accomplish?
Sure. So for me, I've been going to the conference pretty regularly for about 8 years at this point. And for me, the biggest value of events like that is not so much the talks, though there are always some interesting talks, but rather the networking. You know, getting anywhere in life is, of course, it's not so much what you know as who you know in large part. And so getting to meet other people, getting to make connections, getting to find ways that you can work with other people for the benefit of animals, that's always, to me, the most valuable part of the conference. And I think that was the most valuable part of this conference for me as well.
Thanks, Nick. How many people usually attend the AR conferences?
Yeah, I don't know exactly. I think the attendance this year was in the range of maybe 800 to 900 people. So it's certainly a good size, and you have people from across the country. We even had international folks from Canada, Austria, Australia, South Korea, other countries as well.
Okay. Attending or speaking or both?
Both.
Okay. And something that I notice quite a bit is the disproportionate amount of male leaders to female leaders in the animal rights community. Is that evident at places like the conference where you have a lot more male speakers than female speakers? And, like, is that something that you've noticed?
I think it depends where you look. I mean, if you look around the exhibit hall, say, at the different organizations that are there and the people who are tabling on behalf of those organizations, I mean, I certainly did not do a head count or anything like that, but it seems roughly proportionate to me. I think if you look to the larger animal protection organizations, you know, groups like Humane Society, Farm Sanctuary, Mercy for Animals, groups like that, I think you're right. There tends to be more males than females in the top leadership positions. I mean, the exact reasons for that, I guess we could speculate over. But yeah, it does seem to be the case.
It's interesting, isn't it? Nick, you do so much, particularly now that you're working with Farm Sanctuary. There's a lot of concern in the animal advocacy community about burnout. How do you find time to do everything that you do?
Good question. I mean, I know that for me, the way that I don't really feel burned out much. And I think the main reason for that is that we often feel burnout when one of two things is going on. Either number one, we are always paying attention to the extent of animal suffering that's going on. So, you know, we're always watching the latest video on farm animal cruelty. We're always responding to the latest petition about the latest atrocity being done to animals. And we're in that sort of reactionary position where we're constantly hearing about bad things that are going on, and we're constantly trying to put out the latest fire or help out the latest fire. So I think that's one of the things that can contribute to burnout. And the other thing is, if the work that we're doing and putting our passion and time and energy into, if that is not achieving anything tangible for animals, obviously that can be a source of frustration and a source of burnout as well. So for me personally, I mean, I don't even, you know, most of my focus, and has been for years, is not really on the cruelty being done to animals. You know, I think, you know, before too long, you're pretty familiar with that. So my focus mainly on a day-to-day basis is not on that, but rather just on the work that I'm doing or the work that the organization I'm working with is doing. And so by focusing on the work that you're doing, your thought process and your thought pattern is, you know, what can I do next? What can I do that's going to help more animals? What can I do that's going to get more good done? So it's more, it's a way of thinking that is not focused on cruelty, that is focused on tangible success for animals. And it's a more optimistic way of thinking too, because you're looking at the positive being done, even though the negative is so large and so looming. So I think that's one thing that's very helpful. And then, of course, you know, like in any other pursuit or any other interest, you got to have a balanced life. So you need to have hobbies and friends and interests outside of the animal advocacy world to balance that out. And so, you know, I think those two things in and of themselves are very potent for not getting burnout.
That sounds like wonderful advice, Nick. Thank you. As I mentioned earlier, you've recently moved to Farm Sanctuary. You're working as the Compassionate Communities Campaign Manager. Can you explain what that entails and also why you chose to join Farm Sanctuary, please?
Sure. So the Compassionate Communities Campaign, the program I run at Farm Sanctuary, basically our goal is to help animal activists here in the United States and Canada and really around the world just be effective advocates for veg eating in their own community. So we have resources online like how-to videos about how to carry out what we consider to be some of the most effective veg advocacy programs. We have advice on that. We provide free materials like leaflets and veg starter guides and things like that. And we provide direct support in the form of phone conversations, email conversations, you know, basically whatever we can do to help get you started or help keep you going with effective veg advocacy in your own community. That is what we're here to do. So that's what I'm doing for Farm Sanctuary. It's a new program. It just launched in March of this year, 2012. And anybody that wants to learn more or sign up or get involved can visit www.compassionatecommunities.org. In addition to all those the how-to guides online, we also have what we consider to be some of the most important essays and some helpful videos that can really build up your skill as an animal advocate. So even if you've been doing advocacy work for a number of years, we think these videos, these essays, and also some of the blog content that we put up every couple of weeks can be very helpful and thought-provoking and help all of us become better advocates for animals.
Thanks, Nick. It sounds like a very interesting position. We have a question that we ask all of our guests in AR Zone podcast, which has become known as the Ronnie question. As you know, Ronnie Lee couldn't join us today, so I'll ask his question in his absence. What was it that led you to become vegan, Nick, and what inspired you to begin advocating for other animals?
I was 18 when I first sort of found out about how animals are being treated in general. I had gotten a couple books from the library about animal issues. One was Peter Singer's book, Animal Liberation. And that was the first time I had ever seen any of these pictures, heard at all about how animals were being treated. I had never known anyone that was vegetarian. I'd never heard these issues discussed. I didn't have pets growing up, so I had no particular affinity for animals myself. But upon seeing how animals are being treated and then, of course, realizing I could live a happy, healthy life without causing the suffering, I went vegetarian. And then a few months later, when I found out about veganism and eating vegan, I became vegan. So that is what led me to make the change. That was when I was 18, which was 13 years ago at this point.
Thanks, Nick.
Book in the chapter Looking Inward, you talk about reactionary advocacy. Would you speak about that for a minute? For example, what lessons advocates should take from the protests in Philadelphia against the hiring of Michael Vick by the EU?
Yeah, absolutely. So to explain who he is to any listeners that aren't familiar, Michael Vick is a professional football player, and that's American football in the United States. And he was, you know, very well-known player, very popular player, who eventually it was found out he was involved in a dogfighting ring in the United States. In fact, he was purchasing dogs, fighting dogs, and involved in the killing, the brutal killing of many dozens of dogs. So he ended up going to jail for about 2 years. And then after he was released from jail, he was trying to get back into the National Football League here in the U.S., and he was hired by my hometown team, which is the Philadelphia Eagles. And when that happened, there was, of course, a big outcry from animal advocates and, you know, people who care about animals in Philadelphia, who thought it was wrong of the Eagles to hire this guy who was a convicted dogfighter to their team. And so, of course, there were protests, there was media stunts, there was letters to the editor, there were op-eds in the newspaper and calls to boycott the Eagles and things like that. And I pointed this out in the book, my book, Change of Heart, as an example of a reactionary campaign. So basically, something that you and I consider bad has happened, and we get together and condemn it for happening. So in this case, the Eagles hired Michael Vick. It was perceived as sort of a callous thing to do based on his treatment of animals. So we're going to complain to the Eagles that they should not have done it. This sort of campaigning happens a lot. It happens more on the grassroots and individual level than it does on the organizational level. So, you know, you're not going to see large organizations doing a lot of reactionary campaigning, but you see a lot on the individual and grassroots level. And the problem with it that I point out in the book is this. It's like, look, if we want to help as many animals as possible, then our approach should not be running around trying to put out, you know, one of the thousands and millions of fires that already exists and always rushing to the latest fire, always rushing to react to whatever the latest issue that is in the news or in the media. If we really want to help animals, we need to take a step back, look around, look at all the ways that animals are being abused and mistreated and things like that, and then decide, okay, in which one of these areas can I do the most good? What type of work can do the most good for the greatest number of animals? And then we need to, you know, decide what that's going to be, come up with a plan, and then be proactive about it. So we are acting on the sort of general social landscape as opposed to reacting to whatever the latest media story or event is. So, you know, I'm sure a lot of your listeners are on Facebook. Any of us who are on Facebook and who have a number of friends in the animal advocacy field are probably always seeing the latest petition, the latest call for protest or something like that about the latest atrocity done to animals. And those things, you know, they can really bog down our time. They can really make us despondent about the state of the world. And so if we really want to have a good impact for animals and help as many animals as possible, it's probably best to not pay much attention to those and rather, again, take that step back, decide how and where we can do the greatest good for animals, and then be on the offensive about it as opposed to always playing defense.
Ronnie Lee mentioned in a podcast we did a little while back that, again, maybe our listeners don't know, but Ronnie Lee was instrumental in the founding of the ALF back in the 70s. He says that what he sees in a lot of protests is a sort of congratulating of each other among advocates because they were able to tell people how they felt. They were able to show their anger at what was going on. And he asked the question, how does that help other than to make you feel good about the anger that you have? Is that sort of what you're talking about?
Yeah, I think Ronnie puts that very well. And yes, I think that's exactly what I'm talking about. Yeah. We have to look at that. That definitely is the tendency. There's that feeling, right, that as long as I am speaking out for animals, as long as I'm standing up for them, I'm on the right side, I'm on the right team, and I've done my part. And that, you know, that's really not what it's about. You know, it's not about whether or not we stand up for animals. It's not whether or not we speak our mind. You know, that to the pig in a gestation crate, to the animal in a laboratory, you know, those things don't matter at all. All that matters is if you get them out of that situation, if you save their life, if you prevent their cruelty, prevent the cruelty being done to them. So, you know, our intentions, you know, what we're doing, it doesn't really matter. We just need to look to results. Results are what matters. And once we have that mindset, then I think, you know, as Ronnie very eloquently put it, as you just stated, we'll develop that mindset and we'll see some of those flaws of some of the flaws in thinking that as long as we're out there speaking up for animals, that's enough, and that's where we should that we can be content with that.
So along those lines, then another thing that you mentioned in the book is having a bottom line in an organization or in your advocacy, which I, you know, a way to measure how you're being effective. What advice would you give somebody that has a or that wants to start a local group, a type of grassroots organization? How do you go about figuring out what the bottom line is and whether or not you're adding to it?
Yeah, and it's a great question. I'm very glad you bring that up because I feel like for myself, when I look back over my history as an animal advocate, starting in 1999 when I went vegan and joined my college animal rights organization to now, that's 13 years, and looking back over that time, the point at which I went from, you know, contributing something to help animals to being actually effective is a pretty sharp distinction that period of time. And it's really when I started having, you know, because of being taught it by other older animal advocates, starting to have that bottom line mentality. And so basically, you know, I would submit that our bottom line as animal advocates is two things. Number one, we want to spare the lives of as many animals as possible. And number two, we want to spare the suffering or reduce the suffering of as many animals as possible. So, you know, if we have a bottom line mentality as animal advocates, then every decision we make, we have to make with an eye towards that bottom line, with an eye towards what's going to do the greatest good for that bottom line. So just as a company, like let's say Nike Shoes, every decision they make is based on their financial bottom line. So what products they introduce, what celebrities they pay to endorse their product, where they advertise, how they advertise, things like that. All of those are decisions based purely on how much money it's going to make. And we need to have that same laser-like focus when it comes to saving the lives and sparing or reducing the suffering of animals. And so all the, you know, someone that's starting a grassroots group, this certainly takes some time to incorporate and to I guess, put into effect. At least it certainly took me a long time, many, many years. But if we do that, if those grassroots groups do that, that is far and away the thing that will, you know, make them a very, very effective organization. Switching over to that bottom line mentality literally made me exponentially more effective as an animal advocate. I mean, I was no smarter, I was no more dedicated. There was nothing different about me or my dedication or anything like that. But simply by adopting that bottom line mentality that I learned from other animal advocates, you know, I was able to help literally exponentially more animals in the same amount of time, same amount of energy, same amount of money. And so if we look right now, you know, you can look at all the both the national animal protection organizations and also grassroots groups and even individual animal advocates. And you can look at what are they doing, you know, how are they doing it, and what is the number of animals they're saving or reducing suffering of or sparing the suffering of by the particular work that they're doing. And so we should look around. So if you're starting a grassroots group, look at the other grassroots groups and what they're doing. Figure out which one or two are helping literally the greatest number of animals, achieving the greatest tangible change for the greatest number of animals, and then just copy what they're doing or do the same for another individual. And, you know, and then always keep your mind open and your ears open to what other people are doing because, you know, chances are as you learn about what other people are doing and other individuals are doing, chances are you're going to see new things that you hadn't heard of before that are helping an even greater number of animals. And then that's probably the thing that you'll want to do as well. So it takes a little while, time to cultivate that mindset. It is a very different mindset than the mindset you mentioned earlier, Tim, of, as long as we're out there on the picket line, speaking out for animals, raising our voice, that's what our goal is. That's certainly a very different mindset than the bottom line mentality, but it's really the bottom line mentality that is going to do the most good for animals. And an obvious example of that is this. So in 2 years ago, I was still working for the Humane League at the time, and I looked at the Humane League's income and achievements for animals in that particular year. And I looked at the income and achievements for animals of our local SPCA, which is like an animal shelter, we take in and adopt out animals, for the same year. And I found that for the Humane League, because we were focusing on farm animal issues, which is an issue where we really can spare so many animals so quickly because everybody eats meat and there's so many farm animals that are being abused, the Humane League was spending about 55 cents for every animal whose life we impacted, either by sparing them a life of misery on a factory farm or impacting them in some other way. In contrast, the local animal shelter was spending about $750 for every animal they spared by taking it in and adopting it out. So again, that's not because the Humane League was any smarter, more dedicated, anything like that, but just by having that bottom line mentality and putting our time and energy into those issues where we could help the greatest number of animals, we were able to be literally over 1,000 times more efficient in terms of the number of animals we were helping, per dollar and probably per hour of time as well, though I didn't calculate that.
So that reminds me of what I believe that the strategy of vegan outreach is, which is Vegan Outreach is an advocacy organization in the United States, and they switched from doing public protests and they would show up at board meetings of corporations and they would do public protests and stuff, holding signs and whatnot. And they made the decision to stop doing that. And now, from what I can gather, their advocacy is almost exclusively leafleting on college campuses because they decided that that was what they saw as to be the most effective way to make a difference. So that's the sort of change that you're talking about in focus of an organization, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And Vegan Outreach is certainly an example of a very great, very bottom line focused organization. Exactly as you said, to my understanding is the history of the organization. That yes, as they realized, after years of kind of banging their head against the wall, like so many of us do, with our protests and pickets and the issues that we choose to work on, they realized that just by giving people information about factory farming and veg eating, they could help many more animals than say protesting the circus or protesting outside of McDonald's or other things like that. And then after doing that for a while, they further refined it. They realized, hey, we can give out booklets in the downtown areas or we can give out booklets on college campuses. And the latter is going to generate, twice as many, maybe three times as many people switching their diet. So because that's more effective for the bottom line, let's put all or nearly all of our attention there. So yeah, it's a perfect example of how a few individual animal advocates, no different than any of us, adopted a bottom line mentality and then constantly shifted their advocacy in that direction. And as a result of that, they are now helping, hundreds of thousands, probably millions of animals each year, sparing them a lifetime of suffering because they moved in that bottom line direction.
So would you say that this is part of this has to do with the idea that you talk about empathy avoidance in the book, because from what I take from what you wrote in the book, asking people to go vegan or to present the only solution to the problem of completely ending factory farming or abolishing all use of animals altogether, that approach might actually cause people to do nothing at all. Is that part of what this bottom line sort of thinking is involved with, that empathy avoidance?
To take a half step back from there, so if we have that bottom line mentality, then one of the key questions is, of course, going to be, okay, we want to persuade people to change their behavior. We want them to go vegan or at least move towards vegan eating. We want them to boycott fur. We want them to do these other things that benefit animals. So if we want people to make these behavior changes and we want to be effective at that, then the question becomes, how does human psychology work and what sort of messaging and communication is going to be most effective at getting people to make the behavior changes we want them to make? And so that's where, exactly what you're talking about comes into play. And there's a lot of things that come into play, frankly. And certainly there's a lot of aspects of human psychology that it would pay for us to learn about. And that's why what I wanted to research and then write about in Change of Heart, and empathy avoidance is certainly an example of that. So basically the nuts and bolts of empathy avoidance is that people, and that includes you and I, but members of the general public as well, when we know that having empathy for someone or some animal or the environment or whatnot, when we know that having empathy for someone might be inconvenient for us, we try to avoid feeling empathy. So it's a basic psychological principle that's been demonstrated time and time again. And if we want to be effective, it's something for us to keep in mind. The best thing we can do to try to get around that is to introduce the issue, you know, like basically induce the empathy before people know what they'll be expected to do once they have empathy. So instead of, let's say you're producing a booklet and it's a veg advocacy booklet. You want people to go vegan or move towards vegan eating. Rather than putting on the cover, you know, why vegan or, you know, go vegan to help animals and the environment. And then on the inside, you show the cruelty done to farm animals and the health benefits of vegan eating. What you've done here is you basically upfront said, here's what we want you to do. We want you to go vegan. So a person might take that. They're going to see that. And if they know what vegan is or what vegetarianism is, they're probably going to think this is a very hard thing to do. I don't want to do it. It's going to inconvenience me. It's not going to be fun. I'm going to lose my favorite foods. So then if they open the booklet at all, when they see the cruelty going on, they're already going to be putting up these mental walls, using these mental processes to try to avoid feeling empathy for the animals, because they know that once they do, if they do, they might have to go ahead and go vegetarian, go vegan, and that would be really inconvenient. So that's empathy avoidance in action. It's, again, something that's been documented time and time again. So probably a more effective thing to do, and Vegan Outreach is an example of a group that does this. You know, one of their books is called Compassionate Choices. Very generic title, you know, no one really would know what that means upon seeing the cover. But they open the booklet up, they see the images of farm animal cruelty, and it isn't until they've already had that empathy induced and started to feel empathy for the animals and how they're suffering that they eventually get to the message of, here's what you can do to address that problem. So that's just a workaround that we as animal advocates can use to avoid, or, you know, try to avoid as much as we can, the problem of empathy avoidance. And that is, again, just in a nutshell, introduce people, get people to care first before we tell them what they should or could do about it.
Nick, do you find that most people are willing to take on board what you've learned and written about human psychology and behavior? Or do you find that people aren't willing to do what they might assume would compromise their values for the sake of being more effective? Like, do people think that what you suggest would cause them to somehow sell out?
Yeah, it's a good question. More and more people are definitely thinking in that way. And, you know, there's animal advocates like Matt Ball and Jack Norris from Vegan Outreach, like my boss, Bruce Friedrich at Farm Sanctuary, and like some others who have been basically advocating this sort of mindset for years. And it really is catching on. There are more and more individuals and also more and more organizations that are taking that sort of approach, that results-oriented approach, and that's great. So while it is definitely growing and growing and more people are realizing the value in that, it certainly is, you know, it's a struggle, just like getting anyone to change their behaviors is a struggle. So just as if you or I are going out doing veg advocacy, to us it seems so logical that here's the reasons why you should go vegan, and everybody who reads this should realize logically, oh yes, it makes sense for me to go vegan, I'm going to go vegan right now. Logically, that is what should happen 100 times out of 100, but you know that so rarely happens. And the same is true for this behavior change, just like any other behavior change. You know, old habits die hard. It took me years, like even though I sort of intellectually understood this, it took me years to do simple things like, you know, switch the issue that I was working on, cut my hair, you know, do all these different things, some small, some large, that ended up making a big difference for animals. So while there is certainly more and more people adopting this sort of mindset, and that's to the great, great benefit of animals, you know, it always is, it's a struggle for every one of us to break out of our habits. Old habits die hard, as the saying goes. And that's true for us as animal advocates. And so it's always a struggle to break out of the mold, to break out of what we've been doing, and to shift in that direction that's ultimately going to do more good for animals.
Kind of along the same lines as that, Nick, I'm sure you've heard criticisms from certain people that unless an advocate uses the word vegan, unequivocally, then their advocacy just won't be effective and they kind of won't be being honest. Perhaps you've also heard of advocates who say that sometimes they might not worry too much about, say, a tiny bit of cheese that someone serves them on a salad, so that other people don't think veganism is unattainable. What do you think about that?
Yeah, so I think that the first idea you mentioned, the idea that we should always and only advocate veganism, I certainly understand the motivation for that. I think the motivation is, this is what we want people to do, right? We want people to go vegan. And if we, and we know how badly animals suffer in battery cages and other egg farms, on dairy farms, we know the cruelty going on there. So we feel like it would be a betrayal of the animals if we don't advocate veganism, because that is what's going to eliminate the most cruelty. That's what's going to spare the most animals. That is what the right thing to do is. That's what we want people to do. And so I certainly understand the idea that this is what we want, and therefore that's what we should promote. But there's, you know, the question for us as animal advocates is not, am I expressing what I want as accurately as possible? Am I expressing how I think the world should be as accurately as possible? The important question is, what do I say right now that is going to ultimately spare the greatest number of animals? And if we, this is an example of where, instead of just making assumptions about how human psychology works, we can look to the research. So, you know, a lot of folks who believe that we should always and only advocate veganism, they have a common sense assumption that underlies that. And again, it makes sense why you would assume this. And that is that if we encourage people to do anything less, like go meatless on Mondays or even go vegetarian, that yes, people may make that change, but they'll become complacent. So they'll make that small change or that partial change, but then they'll think they're doing enough and they'll stop there. And that would be a bad thing. So, and it's very understandable why that would be a concern. But thankfully, if we look to the research on human psychology, we can see that that's not the case. So it's basically established a psychological fact at this point that people who make small changes become more likely to make larger changes, similar larger changes down the line if encouraged to do so. It's a phenomenon called foot in the door. I write about it in Change of Heart. It's been documented in literally over 1,000 peer-reviewed academic studies that shows that overall it's about a 10% increase. You know, someone who makes a small change is about, overall, if you look at all of these studies together, is about 10% more likely to make the larger change down the line. And what that means for us as animal advocates is that if somebody does make a small change, like going meatless on Mondays, like going vegetarian, like just cutting chicken out of their diet, they become more likely to later go vegan if we encourage them to do so than if they had not made that initial change. So while I understand the concern, thankfully, if we look to the data about how humans work and how the human mind and behavior change works, we can see that, again, it's fortunate people who make a small change become more likely to make a large change. And so, you know, one of the things that I did when I was with the Humane League is I gave a lot of humane education talks to high school students, showed them video of factory farm cruelty, you know, talked about veg eating, things like that. And so, you know, what would I as a humane educator want to encourage these students to do? I mean, ideally, what I really want everyone to do is I want to walk out of that classroom being completely vegan, being ready to deciding to devote themselves to full-time animal rights advocacy, only eating organic food so that they don't poison animals with pesticides, you know, driving as little as they can so they don't run over animals in their car, and so on and so forth. On the other end of the spectrum, maybe I just encourage them to try a few meatless meals. You know, so there's this broad swath of requests I could make of them, from what I actually want each one of them to do to something that's very easy. And so the question is, you know, where on that spectrum do I make my request? Do I make it on one end, on the other, or somewhere in between? And again, the question is not, what do I really want people to do, or what do I really believe? The question is, what encouragement on my part is going to create the most behavior change, the most dietary change, both in the short term and in the long term? And from all the research that I've looked into, from all the communication studies that have looked at this very question, it's called message discrepancy. In other words, how big of a behavior change should I request to my audience? It's a subject that communication researchers have studied. And what they found is that if we want to create the most behavior change, both in the short and the long term, that the request we should make of our audience is that they make a change that is significant. You know, it's not a small change. It is a significant change. But it's one that they could probably picture themselves doing. So if it's hard for them to picture themselves doing it, it's probably not going to be the maximally effective behavior change or the maximally effective message for creating the greatest amount of behavior change. And so you know, from that and from my own experience doing this and other advocacy in education, I think that for most people, it's a meat reduction to vegetarian message that is that hits that point of optimal effectiveness where it is a significant change, but people can picture themselves doing it, and that both creates the most behavior change in the short term. And then again, because we get that foot in the door, ultimately leads to more vegans and more people who really care about animals down the line as well.
Thanks, Nick. So pretty much you believe then that changing the behavior needs to come first and then people's beliefs will follow afterward.
Yeah, it's a really good point. So we all you know, we always think that the way that humans work is we have a particular attitude and then based on our attitude, we choose a behavior that goes with that. You know, that's what we like to think because we like to think we're very logical creatures. But for all of us, including those me, including you, including those listening, that's not the way we work for most issues, including most important ethical issues. A lot of times, the behavior, most of the time, the behavior comes first. You know, something we learn from our parents, from society, so on and so forth. And then only after we have the behavior do we basically come up with an attitude that attempts to justify that behavior. And so we don't always have to change attitudes first before changing behavior. We can change behavior first, and then people who change the behavior will often change their attitude to match up with their new behavior. So a point in case of that is that a lot of people go vegetarian or go vegan for health reasons. You know, they don't know anything about the animal issue. They just think it's going to be healthier, so they make the change. And then once they've made that change, a lot of those people, not necessarily, certainly not all, and perhaps not even the majority, but a large percentage later end up embracing, you know, compassion for animals and opposing the cruelty done to animals on farms. And the reason they've done that is now it's easier for them to do it. You know, their behavior is already in line with that attitude, so it's very easy to adopt that attitude. So that's just one example of how sometimes we can change behavior first and attitude second. We don't need to necessarily totally change someone's mindset about how we should relate to animals before we change the behavior.
Nick, in your Arizona chat, you said something, and I think you said something similar to this in response to what Carolyn asked you, and it also echoes something that Eric Marcus wrote about in his blog maybe 2 years ago. Anyway, what you said in the chat was, even if someone goes vegan, that's nice, but what we really want is for them to be an animal advocate who spends all their free time doing veg outreach. And Eric Marcus said that if a person was going to identify as something, it would be better for them to identify as an advocate for other animals as opposed to identifying as a vegan. And I think that you're saying similar things. And I think I agree with you about it. But can you explain what you mean and why you think it's important?
Sure. So just in terms of practical impact for animals, I think the point that Eric is making is this. I mean, if you are a vegan and you're a vegan for the rest of your life, you know, that's great. You're going to spare, you know, a couple thousand animals over the course of your lifetime from a life of misery, and that's fantastic. On the other hand, if you are an advocate for veggie eating, you can, you know, in an hour or 2 hours of work, you know, you could spend 2 hours this weekend going out, say, volunteering for vegan outreach or compassionate communities or someone else, you know, passing out veggie leaflets. And in that 2 hours, if you get one person to go vegan, you will spare just as many animals as you'll be sparing from your entire life of eating and living vegan. And so that shows that the power that veg advocacy has, the power that animal advocacy has. So, you know, a lot of times you might hear the expression that the best thing any of us can do to help animals is go vegan. Well, that's actually not true. Actually, the best way any of us can help animals is by encouraging others to go vegan. Because rather than just, you know, ourselves or one person, we can get literally dozens to hundreds of people to make that change just with our volunteer time. So I think that's the point that Eric is trying to get to, that, you know, really getting the most bang for your buck is not just getting someone to go vegan, but getting them to actually become an advocate for animals. Of course, an advocate for veg eating, that is. Of course, you know, people are probably not going to be that until they're at least a vegetarian. But it's certainly something important to keep in mind.
Nick, you're not suggesting that it's an either or, are you? You're not suggesting that if I were to become vegan, that's a good thing in itself, but I would be better to not become vegan and become an advocate for other animals and become like a vegetarian leafletter. You're not suggesting that it's kind of like an either or.
Certainly not suggesting that's an either or, no. And I think, you know, there's probably virtually no leafletters or veg advocates of any type who are not at least vegetarian, if not most of them are vegan. So no, obviously we all should be vegan and everyone on this podcast should be vegan and that's the best thing to do for animals. But, you know, number one, let's not stop there. The way we really help animals is not through our own personal veganism, it's through getting others to move in that direction. And number two, keeping that in mind when we communicate with others. So, you know, if we turn someone off from advocacy, or we get, you know, encourage others to do advocacy that's not very effective, we're definitely doing a disservice to the animals, and we would do better by helping other people become effective veg advocates as well.
Yeah, I probably don't disagree with that. Thanks. Nick, the last question we have for you today is about what's up next for you. Are you working on any new projects? And what can we expect from you in the coming months and years?
Yeah, thanks. So for Compassionate Communities at Farm Sanctuaries, we have a couple exciting things in the pipeline or coming out of the pipeline. So one is we have a new leaflet that's entitled Something Better, which is a veg advocacy leaflet that we're very excited about, that, you know, we think will be very effective at persuading people to change their diet. And we are happy to give as many of these out, we're happy to send as many of these out as any individual or grassroots group would like anywhere in the U.S. or Canada. So any U.S. or Canadian listeners, feel free to give me an email at activist@farmsanctuary.org, and we will send you as many of these 16-page booklets as you would like. Also, we have a new video that's going to be coming out in about a month entitled Someone, which is a video of, it's a farm animal cruelty video that introduces you to particular animals. It tells a story of some of the rescued animals at Farm Sanctuary before showing the way those animals would have been treated and what their life would have been like had they not been rescued. So we think it's going to be a nice, powerful addition to the movement. And we're also going to be really amping up our Compassionate Communities program later this year. I'm going to be going around to 10 major cities around the United States and one in Canada as well, to help our supporters and grassroots groups there get going or increase the amount of effective veg advocacy that they're doing. So that'll be this fall, and if anybody's interested in that, and whether I might be coming to a city near them, again, feel free to email me at activist@farmsanctuary.org. For myself personally, I'm right now finishing up research towards the writing of a second book. And so what the second book is, you know, Change of Heart was basically, let's look at the research on psychology and social change to see how we can persuade people to change the behavior. And this new book is, let's look at all the research done on, you know, vegetarian issues, not health stuff, but everything else, and what we as advocates can take away to be more effective proponents of veg eating. Because there's actually a ton of extremely interesting research out there about all sorts of things, you know, why people go vegetarian, why they don't, why they go back to eating meat, you know, what their demographics are, how long they typically stay, you know, whether they start with one motivation and end up having a second, what kind of mock meats the meat-eating public prefers. There's just a ton of peer-reviewed academic research on these issues that virtually no one knows about. I mean, I didn't know about it. There's no animal organization or website that has this stuff on there. So I've been combing through that. I'm mostly done the research at this point, going to be starting the writing fairly soon. So, you know, hope to finish the writing by around the end of the year or early next year, and have that book out sometime next year. So, yeah, those are the things that I'm working on.
Sounds very exciting. It sounds like a really interesting book too. Really wish you the best of luck with it. We sincerely appreciate your time today, Nick. It's been a real pleasure to hear your thoughts. But before we go, would you like to mention anything that we haven't thought to ask you today?
You know, I think the only thing I'd add, again, is if anyone is interested, if anyone listening is interested in doing veg advocacy in your own community, and this includes international folks outside the U.S. and Canada, feel free to visit CompassionateCommunities.org and sign up. Your email, your sign-up will go directly to me, so you'll get a personal response from me. And we can ship materials anywhere in North America, but we can also give advice and direction and guidance to anyone around the world. So, you know, if you want to do veg advocacy in your community, or you want to do more, or you want free materials and you live in North America, by all means, visit CompassionateCommunities.org and sign up. Or even if you're just interested in some of the stuff we post on the blog, I mean, if the conversation we had today was of interest to you, I blog about these sort of things regularly on our blog, and so that may be of interest to you as well. So it's CompassionateCommunities.org, and that's pretty much it. You know, thanks both to you two and to Ronnie for putting this podcast on. It's really a pleasure being here.
Thanks, Nick. Thanks again for your time with us at AR Zone and for everything that you're trying to do for other animals as well.
Hey, same to you.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to AR Zone. Please visit us online at www.arzone.net and look for us on iTunes.